and Diversity. That is located in room 107 of the University Center, and that is where the Aero Archive is. So check that out, and I'm going to post the list of Aaron's top 11 zines on my blog within the next 2 hours, and information on the Aero Archive blog. And Aaron and I are talking about hosting some events together, some zine-related events, so I'll keep you posted on that stuff. So I hope everybody has a fantastic week, and next week I'm playing the long-awaited interview with Allison Mitchell. So please be sure to tune into that. If you want to get in contact with me, you can send me an email, Sarah, S-A-R-A-H dot Mangle at gmail.com. Or you can check out my blog at thesethingsthatpeoplemake.blogspot.com. And as of last week, something very excited happened where now my audio is being hosted on Radio for All. So when you go to the blog, you can be sent to find the archives easier by clicking on a link right in the blog. So I'm really excited that finally happened. And Locavore is up next. Stay tuned to CFRU.
Do you love food? Tune in to Cornucopia, the new show about food and eating.
Every Wednesday from 5 to 6 p.m., Kristen and myself, Lisa, will pick a food and talk about its history, how to grow it, how to cook it, and some fun facts.
You can tune into the show on CFRU 93.3 FM or online at cfru.ca.
If you have any questions, comments, or ideas for the show, send us an email at cornucopia@cfru.ca.
So tune in Wednesdays from 5 to 6 and work up a healthy dinner appetite with Cornucopia.
Are you looking for fresh, local, organic food at an affordable price? Then Plowshare Farm is what you're looking for. With our three workhorses, we grow more than 60 different kinds of certified organic vegetables, herbs, berries, and cut flowers. Let Plowshare Farm put fresh, healthy produce on your table every week this summer through our CSA Garden Membership Program. Plowshare Farm members get a box of freshly harvested produce delivered each week for less than you'd pay at the farmer's market. Enjoy our newsletters with recipes and nutritional information about what's in your box each week, plus stories from the farm letting you know what's happening in your garden. Visit us online at plowsharefarm.wordpress.com. Let Plowshare Farm grow fresh, healthy produce for you and your family this summer. plowsharefarm.wordpress.com.
This is Walter Garrison, the host of Locavore on CFRU 93.3 FM. And thank you very much for coming and tuning into our show today, Thursday, January 27th. Today we're going to be talking about season extension, and we're going to be talking to a very interesting man, Martin Rona, who's been doing work at the Guelph Center for Urban Organic Farming on season extension and growing crops in the winter time. It's a very interesting topic, season extension, something we really don't think about that much. Quite frankly, it's something that we don't do enough of. And in fact, there's a great opportunity to do a lot more with respect to growing crops in the late fall, in the early winter, and throughout the winter and into the spring. Now, one of the pioneers in season extension is a gentleman by the name of Elliot Coleman. And anybody that's been involved in the local agriculture movement or the organic movement would know Elliot Coleman's name quite well. He used to have a show on the Learning Channel called Gardening Naturally with he and his partner, Barbara Damrosch, who herself is a noted author in the field of horticulture. And they have a farm in Maine, near the Penobscot Bay, which they have used to grow vegetables and produce year-round. It's really very interesting what they've done that far north as far as growing food for themselves. And they've built, over the last several years, a thriving business as producers and purveyors of excellent winter vegetables, which they raise without major inputs of heat, extra light, or growth-promoting chemicals. And the key to their business can be summed up in three words: organic, local, and authentic. And what they have done really sort of sets what we as consumers of produce in the wintertime eat on its head, actually. Coleman talks about Americans having grown to depend on winter crops from California and Florida. He talks about the U.S. building highways and transport systems to get them to market in the north, and water being subsidized for irrigation. And it's, quite frankly, U.S. taxpayers that are subsidizing this. If you know, for example, the first name of the farmer that you deal with, then the food you buy can be labeled authentic. It may not be organic, but certainly it can be labeled as authentic. So, you know, it's very interesting when you look at it. When we look at latitude, and Martin's going to talk about this today, if you look at a place like Maine, Maine has the same latitude as Saint-Tropez. So Saint-Tropez, for example, and Maine get the same amount of winter daylight, and daylight is just as important as temperature. And Coleman's found that in southern France and northern Italy, locally raised crops are exactly what people expect to find in their market any time of year. And I guess when we look at local crops, we have to look at selecting winter hardy vegetables. And that is the first challenge. And the second challenge is, once you've selected those plants, is to protect them from severe freezes in the wintertime. And that involves using plastic greenhouses that arch above rows, and maybe row covers as well, too. It's something that on the surface would appear to be a costly initiative, but actually growing crops in tunnels is actually economical. And if you look at a 3,000 square foot greenhouse now, in this is U.S. dollars and states cost, it cost them $6,000 to put up. So 3,000 square feet, $6,000 to put up, that's $2 a square foot. Try and find a house for $2 a square foot. We're looking at costs, housing costs being, oh, I would say anywhere from $100, $125, $150 a square foot to start. So looking at a greenhouse to grow vegetables for yourself, that works out to about $2 a square foot, at least down in Maine. And hopefully they hope to gross about $100,000 a year growing greenhouse crops. Now, that to me is if you can do that, I think you'd be well on the way to sustaining yourself. So who would they sell to? Well, they'd sell to local markets and to local chefs. And looking at something like, for example, golden and deep red beets accompanying locally raised salmon at a restaurant. You know, salad greens, fennel leeks accompanying a leg of lamb, radishes, baby carrots, things that you don't expect to find produced and harvested fresh in the wintertime. It's quite possible. Coleman wrote a book called Four Season Harvest, which is probably the seminal book on season extension and what is possible, at least for us that live in northern climates. So I highly recommend that book. Check it out. Now, we're going to do an interview today with Martin Rona, who's been working, helping out at the Guelph Center for Urban Organic Farming. And what Martin's done is he's worked on growing winter vegetables in a greenhouse under row covers. So we're going to be talking with Martin today about what he's done with respect to producing vegetables in the wintertime. I wanted to ask about the future and what you see for initiatives that may be done with respect to the season extension work that's being done at the Guelph Center for Urban Organic Farming.
Well, I think part of the future could be, you know, involving students more and doing research here, and reaching out to the community, showing people that they could make fairly simple structures as the hoop house that I built outside. They could easily build that in their backyard and grow lots of food locally, fresh, in their backyard. It's not that hard. It actually does work. It doesn't sound like it will work, but it actually does. And so we could have workshops involving people of the community to teach people that it's quite a feasible thing to grow fresh vegetables in your backyard in the winter.
I want to thank you, Barton, for talking with us about the work that you're doing at the Guelph Center for Urban Organic Farming. So I'm standing in the middle of the greenhouse here at the GCUOF, and I see we have several beds in here with straw in between the beds. We have row covers over the beds and support systems for these row covers in order to have vegetables grow over the winter time. It's December 2nd today, and it's quite warm in here. Well, it's actually a lot cooler outside. So, Martin, could you go over how the greenhouse itself was prepared for in-ground growing and the greenhouse structure itself?
Okay, the structure is a large metal frame with two layers of plastic that are inflated. Well, actually, one half is. The other half isn't working so well now, but we'll work on that. And then inside, when I first came here, the ground was hard as a brick. It was like soil that had been compacted while it was wet during the construction of the frame. So it was pretty much useless for anything. And I spent about 3 to 4 months, about 3 hours a day, digging with a shovel to turn this into usable soil and adding large amounts of wood chip rich, mineral rich compost from outdoors. And now we have very nice soil in here. And with our inflatable plastic structure and our inner layer of floating row covers, We should be able to maintain these plants in here all winter long, even at minus 25 degrees. They may look a little iffy for a few days, but when the sun comes back, they'll all spring back to life again. So I'm fairly certain that this will work.
I remember helping prepare the soil, and I remember how compacted it actually was in here and turning it with a shovel. And so you've done an impressive amount of work to actually make it as fertile as it is. It's very lush and green in the production rows here. So certainly there's the whole aspect of soil preparation before you put a greenhouse over a plot of land to grow vegetables. And I remember working in that greenhouse, and the soil was weedy and it was quite compacted. So I did some work, but Martin did a lot of work in preparing that soil and making it more amenable to grow crops from both transplants and from seedlings. So the next step when we look at season extension is the greenhouse structure itself. And in this next segment, Martin's going to talk about the greenhouse structure and how it's set up and how it works for season extension. So let's take a walk around the greenhouse, and I just want to discuss some of the structural aspects of it with you. Mm-hmm. We have the support system here, and we have a side rail along the support system, and we have, is it fiberglass on either end or polycarbonate?
That's polycarbonate.
Polycarbonate, okay. And how is it inflated? Could you describe the system for that?
Well, we have a very long extension cord that goes to the parking lot temporarily, and we're plugged into a light post, and that comes through the extension cord into the greenhouse. We have two small blowers that run continuously. That inflates our greenhouse. We should be getting a solar panel system this week, 1 kilowatt of solar energy, and that should power all our systems here. But because of the weather, this year's been kind of wet this fall, so the installation company's been a little delayed, and we're hoping that they'll begin soon. And we're going to have a small house built with batteries, inverters, and everything, and we can still run everything off the same at 120 volt. So that if the solar system, for whatever reason, goes down, we can still always use the extension cord to the parking lot method. But we hope to be off the grid. That's our aim, yeah.
So you will be off the grid, but you could get back on the grid if need be.
Yes, yes. And we also have a well. Finally, we haven't had water for the first 2 years. Now we have a well that has been dug for us by the good people at the groundwater research facility. And we're able to use their well. We haven't got a pump yet, but that's coming soon. And that will also be plugged into the solar batteries through the inverter in that little building that we're putting up there. And we also have a roof vent that opens and closes when it gets too hot in here. And that should be automated. And that will also run off the solar system. But at the present time, we still have some glitches with that system, which may take a few months to settle. But we're in no hurry. It's the winter. We don't need the roof to be open. So by the spring, hopefully, that will be up and running.
With respect to the well and water and irrigation, are you irrigating at all in the wintertime or not?
No, most of these plants, once the soil is moist, it stays moist, and it probably will stay moist probably till things start growing again. And plants in here don't really grow from about 6 weeks before and after the winter solstice. So everything just goes, it grows imperceptibly or it becomes dormant. So it needs very little water. And once we get into the second week of February and the day length gets long enough, usually the day length has to be more than 10 hours for plants to grow. So it's the latitude that's important, not the temperature. And that's quite counterintuitive to most people. I think it's too cold to grow things here, but it's not. We have the same latitude as southern France. And they grow vegetables outside in southern France without any greenhouses. Mind you, they have a warmer climate. But we have the same day length. And often during winters, we have more sunlight than they do. So it's perfectly feasible to grow things here.
So with the right crop selection, it is possible to grow crops in the wintertime. And we really have to think about this. We have the same latitude as southern France, and therefore the same day length, really. In fact, even higher light levels at times in the wintertime. Now, certainly they are warmer from a temperature standpoint, but still we can get production. And we're going to talk a little bit later about row cover use and how that can increase the soil temperature, and the ambient air temperature would seem to allow for more effective photosynthesis for these plants to actually grow. So in our next segment, Martin is going to talk about the ideal planting time for season extension. I wanted to ask you about when you think the ideal planting time is. When would you start planting for season extension to grow underneath the greenhouse and underneath row covers? What's the interval between plantings you'd use, and when would you stop planting?
Okay, I would start, if this was my greenhouse and it was up to me, I would start planting in probably the beginning of August with carrots and beets and things like that, root crops. The end of August, I would start planting my greens, and I would probably stop planting by the end of September. And I'd maybe leave a week between plantings, or 2 weeks, just to get some succession crops going. And unfortunately this year I was a bit late, but I was constrained by having the summer crops in here. So yeah. Maybe next year we can work out a compromise, or next year we can have a compromise between summer and winter crops.
That's interesting because it certainly puts the idea of planting and harvesting on its head. It spins at 180 degrees because you're actually very actively planting in August and September in preparation to have food available for you for the next several months.
Oh, yes. We want to stock our outdoor refrigerator.
I wanted to ask.
So we've got a situation where, if you look at it, you've got this basically just before winter solstice. If you look at, I guess, 6 weeks before, that is when you're going to end planting. And he talked about successional planting. So essentially, you could start in late August and start seeding, for example, carrots, and seed them every 2 weeks. And then if you think winter solstice is going to be December 21st, you might want to plant every 2 weeks up till, let's say, about November 8th, something like that. So it's quite possible to have a successional harvest of greens, of root crops, following this method. Okay, now we're going to actually get into what crops Martin is working with at the GCOF, and he's going to talk about the specific ones that he's put in the ground and harvested from this year.
I'd like to ask about the crops that you're growing here, when you planted them, and why you chose these specific crops to grow here under the greenhouse and under the row covers.
Okay, well, most of the crops I've grown here are we know are winter hardy. Kale, mizuna, well, there's two types of kale. Bordeaux spinach, arugula, red oak lettuce, cold hardy spinach, nice mesclun mixture, mustard greens, all kinds of things that are traditionally even used in for winter gardens, at least for fall and spring gardens, but they all manage through the winter as well. Another reason I chose some of these crops, because they're the only seeds I could scrounge.
Okay, so necessity.
Yeah, necessity. Yeah. And then at one point, I did go to William Dam Seeds, and I bought some Asian green seeds. Unfortunately, I planted some of my crops a bit too late because the summer crops were still in here, and we wanted to keep them till Thanksgiving so that we could have our last big sale, then remove the summer crops. So there's some beds that I managed to plant at the end of summer, at the end of August, and they're doing very well. They're quite mature. There's other crops that I didn't plant till the mid-October, but surprisingly, they're actually almost mature, which I didn't expect. I thought I was a few weeks late, but they're still okay. And then there's some that I planted that are still very small. That was October 25th was my last planting of Asian greens. And so they've sort of gone into a state of dormancy, and by mid-February they should start to grow. And by end of February, early March, we should have a nice crop. So I have plants in all different stages of succession in here as well. Apparently plants that are quite mature, fairly large, don't do as well with cold temperature. They succumb to stress more easily. Plants that are teenagers are a lot tougher, and they can withstand more winter stresses and bounce back more easily. So we have everything from very small to sort of mid-sized to almost mature plants. So we should have some good food to last us all winter and right till our outdoor spring crops start producing.
Now, I see leaf litter surrounding some of the plants here, mm-hmm. like the kale. Could you tell us why you actually have that here?
Well, I'm not sure if it's a good idea, but it's a bit of an experiment. It may provide some insulation around the kale. Outdoors, it's usually a good idea. You can keep your kale outdoors with lots of straw or leaves, till Christmas. Indoors, it may actually prevent the sun from heating up the soil around the plants, so it may not be a good idea. But I'm doing it as an experiment and not necessarily being my idea, but other people have input as well. And if it works, it's something we can continue. And if it doesn't work very well, then we'll scrap that idea next year. So there's many different things that you're always experimenting with when you do something like this.
Have you tried any of the crops that have been growing underneath the greenhouse and in the tunnels here at all?
Oh, yes. Last night I had a delicious dinner of mesclun with some arugula and some lettuce. And within a half an hour of cutting it, I brought it home and had a lovely, delicious salad. And it's very satisfying to have something that's fresh, that's local, that you've grown yourself. And because of all those reasons, it's very precious. You don't want to waste it. And you really enjoy it to the full when it's something that you've spent so much time nurturing.
In addition to the time challenges and the time constraints of trying to get in here to plant, and I see the remnants of the tomato ropes for mm-hmm. the indeterminate tomato varieties you had here, what are other challenges that you've found that you've had to deal with in season extension?
One small challenge, I guess, is the meadow voles, a chipmunk, and a great many mice. But unfortunately, there's a weasel that lives here. I've seen him entering the greenhouse as I'm leaving in the evening. And he's actually done a very good job on the meadow voles. In the corner, actually, I dug my own little pit. I put in a 5-gallon plastic pail, put in some wheat or some grains, and meadow voles love that little trap. They all hop in there, and then when they're stuck in there and can't get out, along comes the weasel and has a little treat. So actually, if you went over and looked now, you'd see one partially eaten meadow vole and some other ones that are probably waiting for tomorrow's dinner or maybe this evening's dinner. So that's a small challenge. They've done a bit of damage in the corner there if one of the kale was partially eaten. The other challenge earlier on was with water. Last winter when I had a small garden here, I had to bring water from a creek about 200 meters away with a wheelbarrow. And I'd bring like 4 or 5 gallon pails of water with a wheelbarrow just to keep everything moistened. We tried rainwater, but during dry periods, that didn't work. We tried melting snow, but when we ran out of snow, it was to the creek with the wheelbarrow. So that's how hardcore I am.
So explain the water aspect again. If you're not irrigating, what place does water have with respect to season extension?
Okay, once the soil's moist enough when you plant, the first little while I was just using a watering can. I have quite a few rain barrels that I brought in here, black rain barrels that I filled up with water, which help absorb sunlight and keep the temperature fairly mild in here. And I've been trying to save that water, not really use it once the weather gets quite cold. And I'm At this point, I'm not watering at all. I probably won't have to water until, if we get a week of sunny weather, I might, and it gets quite warm in here. If, for example, if it was a nice, bright, sunny day all day today, and it was zero outside, it might be 15 or 18 in here. And with the row covers on, that prevents some of the evaporation. But if plants aren't growing, there's not a lot of evapotranspiration happening. So, yeah, we could probably get away with that watering for quite a long time. So the water barrels there now are doing a different job. They're just trying to act as a heat sink. And then later on, when things start to perk up in mid-February, then I'll have to start using them as a water source for the plants again.
So they're serving a dual purpose here.
Yeah. And right, that water supply I've got there, like, that's probably 700 or 800 gallons of water in rain barrels that I've dragged laboriously with a plastic bucket.
Right.
Doing things the third world way, which I don't mind. It's good exercise.
Well, but it's interesting because have you done any, or is there any research going to be done on how much water you're actually using to maintain the beds here at all?
At this point, my research consists of sticking my finger in the soil. If it's moist, it's good to go. But it would be nice as a project for some of the students to, you know, use some proper equipment and, you know, take measurements and it would make a good little project for one of the organic farm students here.
And speaking of what you talked about with respect to research in temperature change, has anybody done any research for either the ambient air temperature underneath the row covers or the soil temperature underneath the row covers?
Again, I would love to do that if I had the equipment. But at this point, you know, I'm just looking after things, trying to make sure everything grows. And I just like to act as a support person for people who want to do projects. If there's students that would need extra help, I'd be glad to help them out. Or if people want to do doctorate studies, I'd be glad to act as a support for them. And yeah, there's lots of interesting research that could be done with this facility. And it's at this point...
From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Hundreds of people in jail for practicing their freedom of expression. People are tortured for expressing their freedom of expression. Thousands of people sacked from their jobs.
As the crackdown intensifies in Bahrain, the White House keeps its meeting with the Crown Prince under wraps, with no announcement before he met with President Obama this week. A White House statement made no mention of the repression. We'll go to Manama for the latest, then to Puerto Rico.
A natural gas pipeline, 92 miles, just going across the mountains and the rivers and of Puerto Rico, across the center, 92 miles. The island's only 100 by 30 miles. And we're going to build 92 miles and just destroy the environment of Puerto Rico.
Controversy over a proposed natural gas pipeline in Puerto Rico heats up ahead of next week's visit by President Obama, the first official presidential visit to Puerto Rico in 50 years. We'll speak with Arturo Masal, director of the Scientific Commission of Casa Pueblo, a Puerto Rican group leading opposition to the pipeline project. Then, Area 51. It's 75 miles outside Las Vegas and the most famous military installation in the world, yet it's never been acknowledged by the U.S. government.
In 1955, by presidential order, 60 square miles of this prohibited area were set aside for a special purpose. Overall security in this area is the highest yet to be maintained in this country, even higher than that of the Manhattan Project.
Today, Annie Jacobson, author of Area 51, an uncensored history of America's top secret military base. The book draws on thousands of declassified CIA and military documents. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Obama administration's intensifying its secretive bombing campaign in Yemen in the absence of wounded Yemeni President Ali Abdullah Saleh. The New York Times reports the U.S. is exploiting Saleh's departure for medical treatment in Saudi Arabia to increase drone and fighter jet strikes against militant targets. Last week, U.S. warplanes killed a prominent al-Qaeda operative along with a number of other militants in southern Yemen. Witnesses report four civilians were